No, she teaches.
It's 1505.
Okay, thank you all. Today is March 14th, and we're at the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on General Government. Before we get started, I'd like to go put on for the record, I have a note here to please excuse co-chair Representative Smith, for he is not here today. So we have that now on the record. And today we were doing a public hearing on SB 5535, Department of Revenue, Property Tax and Special Programs, and the Property Tax Division, Mr. Gary Humphrey as administrator. Special Programs, which is Mr. Eric Smith as administrator of business. Whoa, wait a minute. Gotta make a sound. All right, we are now live.
Chair Manning, members of the committee, my name is Gary Humphrey, and I am with your Department of Revenue and the Property Tax Division.
And Eric Smith, the Business Division Administrator for Department of Revenue as well.
So as you talked about a little bit, Chair Manning, we're going to talk to you today about property tax. I'm going to go over and talk a bit about our property tax administration and what our involvement as a department and how we work with the counties. And then Eric will take it from there to talk about some of our other programs, small programs, other agency account, marijuana tax. And so we'll kick in with property tax first. So this little graphic kind of gives a nice high-level overview of how the property tax system kind of works and our involvement. So that first part, that first line, talks a bit about some of the department's functions, and I'll get into each of those in more detail as we go through this. But so we have some central assessment work we do for property valuation. We have a mapping function or cadastral that we do within the agency or the division, industrial property valuation, some county assistance, lots of things that we do under the county assistance area that we work with, and then some forest land valuation. So that kind of makes up some of the department activities, and then really you get to the middle of the county property tax administration. The 36 counties in the state carry so much of the bulk, the everyday administration of the property tax system and working with all their residents. So it's $12.4 billion that represents on a biennial basis, or the most recent, that goes to local governments to help fund services there. That's kind of second only to the personal income tax in terms of dollars generated that support government-type services, the personal income tax, of course, being state level, and the property tax being at the local government level. So you have a breakdown there at the bottom of how much goes where, schools being the predominant one with $5.1 billion, cities with $2.6, counties with $2.1, so that's similar, billion. Special districts, things like fire, ambulance, water, roads, irrigation, various districts that exist, parks and rec, community colleges, and then urban renewal. So those are kind of the high-level breakdown of where the money goes. So just a little bit on the overview. The 36 counties, they have, usually have a county assessor, county tax collector. Sometimes it's the same person. In many cases, it's kind of the same person that's both the assessor and the collector for the county. They'll do the bulk of the work, as I said, to value property and collect the tax. So department really comes in with providing support, assistance, training, oversight to the counties, and we'll dig into that a little more right now on the next slide. So in our partnering with them, we just have a lot of interaction going back and forth with the counties daily for many of the staff, many of the managers. We'll do some things like winter, summer conferences together. So we have a winter conference, summer conference, and then we have other meetings. So we are called joint tax meetings that we have in the fall and the spring, that we all get together and go through a variety of topics, working together as counties. I have calls every 2 weeks with the president of the Association for County Assessors, and we update on a variety of topics, whatever happens to be going on. We have lots of what we call tech group meetings. The department typically kind of sets up a lot of the logistics for that, runs a lot of those, but definitely counties also run some of those meetings. So those are a variety of topics, whether it's around exemptions or whether it has to do with some certain valuation type issue going on, commercial, industrial, that kind of thing. We issue, as an agency, some standards that we provide around things like residential, commercial, appraisal methods, land valuation. There are standards that the agency has to put forward for to be applied across the state, looking for some uniformity across the state in how we administer the property tax system. There's a piece around ratio review. When we talk about monitoring valuation activities for conformance to real market value, we get reports from the counties that we review each year to see how they're doing at getting real market value determined and how close that is to what's actually happening in the sales activity. And that's one, also reflected in one of the KPMs that we have that we'll probably talk about maybe more in a few weeks. But KPM 6 is one that relates to see how close counties are getting at getting real market value on the roll through their mass appraisal type techniques.
Okay. It would be a lot helpful for, we got a lot of new such as myself up here. So when you refer to KPM 2, we have no idea what you're talking about. So if you have a slide that have that up there, it'd be very helpful.
Yeah, Chairman, I don't have that today, a particular slide that talks about it. It's just the key performance measures that the agency is reporting to you on. And so it is in all the materials that we have in the big presentation. I think yesterday Joanne referred to one around customer service. So I believe we'll be reporting more on those when we come back for round two.
Okay. Yeah, so. And that would be helpful because that's one of the things that I walked away yesterday, you know, knowing the reference to the KPIs and I'm like, okay, well, I hear what's saying, but I have no idea, you know, I see nothing up there. So it doesn't help me understand the presentation any better.
Yeah. Okay.
So KP probably has a different meaning to you.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, we can definitely point you to where those are at.
Okay.
The detail information. So some the other parts that we do in some of the training and assistance, we'll do appraisal classes. We'll do topics like special assessments, Measure 50, exemptions, local budget law. There's lots of examples of training that we give to the counties as part of our working with them.
Mr. Chair, how do you do that training? Share with me all your cost-effective, high-tech ways that you're reducing mileage and you're servicing the maximum number of people for the least taxpayer dollars.
All right. Sure. It's Chair Manning, Senator Johnson. What we've been doing over the last several years is trying to develop more online training that's available to the county. So we've, I don't think I have the number with me, but we've done adding several more online training options for the counties so they can go online and get those. We still do in-person classes, so we are still traveling around doing training, but we're offering much more in terms of online for them to go and get the training they want.
Follow. Do you have a minimum number of confirmed attendees before you launch for La Grande?
We have... Well, we have a desired amount.
That wasn't my question.
We have, I say it that way because we've imposed or we've said that we need to have a certain number of attendees to come, but with the eastern counties, it's very difficult for them to get the number of attendees to really fit what we would say is cost effective to come out. So we've sometimes had to try and compromise a little bit with them to make sure we're able to get still training that they need for their continuing ed and...
You answered my question. I don't like what I heard. I mean, if this is important training, if they're required to get it, what do they want you to do? Drive to each one of the counties individually so you can service them? I think that there needs to be a little conversation with AOC about this needs to be a two-way street. This is important training. So why don't you gather the northern tier guys, the southern tier guys? Everybody needs a little skin in the game these days.
Chairman Senator Johnson, I want to infer that we go to each location.
I know I was a little hyperbolic, but right. You get my point.
Yeah, all right. Otherwise, on the assistance, just some of the things we'll do is we'll assist with certain appraisal activity with the counties if it's some complex properties. We're doing that. We'll interpret statutes and rules as part of that activity of assisting counties. And with a special focus on statewide issues that might exist, when those are coming up, then we definitely try to, as an agency, weigh in more on those issues. So I'm going to jump ahead to industrial central valuation.
One other thing that, Mr. Turner, that I want to ask about is the appraisal piece of this and the guidance that you're giving counties. It seems to me that some counties may be following formulaic appraisal increases, and I don't know how that's working. What I'm hearing is, well, it's a seller's market now, and we have to adjust values given that the economy is coming back from the horrible place that it was. Tell me a little bit about how some of those values are set and how you are able to assure yourself that, or the agency, that they're correct.
Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, we... When I was referring a little bit to some of this ratio review activity, or the activity to see if counties are keeping real market value on the rolls, so they're looking at sales activity to see that they're coming up to that. So certainly they're looking to compare to the actual sales taking place in the market, and that will get incorporated into their mass appraisal techniques to determine values across the county. So it is going to reflect what's actually happening in the market. Now, of course, with the limitations we have, like Measure 50 on how much that can grow, there's a cap, the 3% type of increase a year. So even if the values, real market value, is jumping much more than that, the assessed value is not going to keep pace with that market. But they're reflecting it in their real market value calculations to keep up with the market, see what's going on. Does that answer your question?
It does. Let me put this in context. I have a disabled veteran who lives in a very modest accommodation, and his property taxes shot up from $168 to almost $700. He doesn't know if he can stay there. And we've been to the tax board, and the answer that I get is, well, you know, the economy's coming back, and we just adjusted all of our stuff to fit the robust economy. That's cold comfort to this guy.
Yeah, and I would be able to look at it more to see why it would jump that much if it was just simply, just market activity.
Glad you asked. I'll send you the file.
Okay. We'll take a look. All right, thanks. In our industrial and sectoral assessment work, so we appraise industrial properties that are valued over $1 million in value at the state level. Typically, this is actually a back and forth with the counties in terms of who's going to value, but generally the state's going to value the larger industrial properties. That valuation that we've done is, last year was like $31.5 billion. In property value for those industrial accounts. So this is, you know, electronics, wood, technology, various types of industrial type properties, 830 or so sites that we value. And then for central assessed businesses, that's $22.5 billion in value that the department has determined and then passed along those values to the counties.
What degree of controversy still resides in the centrally assessed businesses, and are there a suite of bills that are coming at this issue right now? I know that for a while in past biennia, this was extraordinarily controversial. What's sort of the status of the crankiness?
Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, there's definitely appeals in this area going on, and one of the more recent has to do with communications type companies. You've probably been hearing some about Comcast litigation that goes on, for example, in the central assessment area. Companies that, when they jump over to be centrally assessed and now their intangible type value is included in the base, that can be a really big amount and lends to some controversy. I think legislatively wise, this session, I know there's a bill that's kind of specific to a certain situation, but otherwise, there's some being considered around what's called a gigabit exemption that was something the legislature did a couple of years ago that's being considered in a couple of bills. So some of that's being looked at. Those are pretty specific to like communications type companies. So there is some. There's litigation. In this area, differences. It's because it's large dollars at stake.
Mr. Chair, would it be possible for the department to get a copy of the legislation, all of it, and give it to the professional staff and ask that it be circulated among the committee?
Yes.
Because the outcome of the litigation and the outcome based on decisions the agency makes could have a profound effect as it rippled back through the business community here. And I'm just curious to see what the totality of the bills are.
Okay.
Staff. and make sure that ensure that all of the committee is also informed and get a copy of it as well.
We'll do that. I'm sure people back at the department are looking on that right now.
Cool.
So the last point, the tax amount represented by this is around $654 million in tax revenue to local governments. That's really an estimate of the tax, because you have to really drill down to each county and what actually ends up being the tax effect, but that's approximately what that probably represents. So a significant amount of revenue that flows to the local governments. Flip over. There's just this is just a little graphic to kind of give a picture of how that value has risen since 2012 in terms of these types of properties for industrial. So from approximately in the 18 billion or so, under 20 billion neighborhood in 2012 to over 31 billion of value last year in 2016. We'll have a few more accounts that are appraised that come to the department too, but it's basically they're just increasing in value, those types of accounts. So I'm going to switch over to forest land valuation, timber taxes. We do have, the agency does have a role here also. We do some special assess. We determine special assess values for forest land, over 7.9 million acres of private forest land in Oregon that are valued using these special assess values. We have a small tract forest land severance tax, forest products harvest tax that we administer. Small tract is 10 to 15,000 or 5,000 acres. There's an application. There's a special assessed value that's applied, and there's also then the severance tax paid when it's harvested. The money that comes out of these taxes basically gets put in to fund Oregon Forest Practices, Emergency Fire Fund, OSU's Forestry Research, Oregon Forest Research Institute, OSU College of Forestry, or some of the areas that, or the areas that benefit from that. Jump to senior and disabled citizen property tax deferral then. I know I'm hitting a variety of things. We just have a variety of programs that are in the property tax division. So senior disabled citizen property tax has had a few different over the years, not the last few years, but legislative changes that were made to try and rein it more in under control in terms of the spending years ago. It's a kind of a loan program, if you will, to where the state pays the property tax on behalf of qualifying seniors or disabled citizens, and then a lien is placed against the property for when the property sells to repay that loan, if you will, that the state has made by paying the property tax. And that's usually how it's recovered, is when there is a sale of the home, that's when the state is paid back on the property tax and goes into the fund that is used for the deferral. There was, in the last year, $13.4 million paid out on behalf of participants. There's around 6,200 program participants right now in these homes.
Yes, Senator?
How well understood do you think this program is by people that participate in it? And let me give you a corollary. Mm-hmm. I don't know about my colleagues, but our office has certainly heard from a lot more people who have gotten the second mortgages. I mean reverse mortgages, and they are unaware of property tax obligations in those reverse mortgage situations. Every once in a while we get a call on these where someone didn't realize that there would be an opportunity for the state to recapture the tax accommodation on the front end. And what I'm really asking you is, given the issues that your agency deals with, do you think that this is well understood, that it isn't just a situation of, well, I'm elderly, I get to pass on taxes, but that people actually know that there will be a real effort to recoup the state's front-end loading of this program?
Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, kind of difficult to answer how well people know about it. I mean, we do have a number of participants. I think we have through... later on, I was going to talk a little bit about through DHS and working with the Agency and Disability Resource Connection. I know that there's efforts made there to make sure people are aware of the program and how to stay in the program, because there's a recertification requirement. You know, generally across the population, how well people are aware of that this is available and what they can do, I don't I could have to see if there's a way that we know.
Perhaps, perhaps you wouldn't, Department of Revenue wouldn't be on the front end of the problem. I'm guessing that maybe if there were complaints that they would come in through senior services, or they might come someplace other than people calling you saying, well, gee, we didn't know that grandma was going to have to, this would get taken out of the sale of grandma's home. And so perhaps I'm asking the wrong guys, that you're too far downstream from this whole conversation. But I'd sure like to know, because it seems to me that sometimes people take advantage of these programs without their heirs knowing, or without them fully understanding that there would be a recapture at the end.
Yeah, one thing I can add to that, because of a recent change that dealt with when there's a transferee, when there is a transfer of the property, not through sale necessarily, that we had a situation where heirs were finding out that they were now liable for the tax. So if the person that was in the home, the qualifying person, had passed away, then and now we were contacting for collection under a statute that was adopted just a couple of years ago. So we did have some of that hit the news, where we were collecting, and through some of our kind of standard collection processes, we were catching some people in the net that was pretty difficult. So we made some adjustments to our process and how we're working on those. That's specific to transferees, though, and I don't know if that might be what you've heard about some, but it does involve heirs. So,
Thank you.
We'll see what we can find. Okay. So I mentioned the amount there and the program participants. This fund itself, the deferral revolving account, has stabilized and grown. So when you did legislation a few years ago to try and get that under control, it seems that the fund has stabilized and is growing from what it was. So it's funding the program quite sufficiently right now. Cadastral. Mapping to me, but cadastral type services the department's involved with. We establish and communicate mapping standards used by counties as they're creating maps, so we provide some standards, quite voluminous material for manuals for that. Obviously, the maps are necessary for identifying property boundaries, zoning, ownership, when there's a change in boundaries, to get those corrected. There's 9 counties that contract with the department to maintain their maps for them, because they don't have sufficient resources to do them themselves. There are a few, not sure how many, that actually contract with other counties also, but we have 9 that currently work with the department. We have the Oregon Map Program, or ORMAP, that's administered through our division, working with counties and board. So that's been going on. It's funded partly by recording fees. It's a statewide digital cadastral base map is the goal. I think the goal finish date for that now, at least for the current goal of getting all the state digital maps in this system, is 2020. So that's kind of where we're at with ORMAP. Funding streams, just a little bit about that. Over 60% for property tax division comes from general fund. We also get some revenue that comes from the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance, CAFA, and I know that's a kind of a difficult one to get straight what that CAFA stands for, and also some from mapping that helps with our assessment role. Primarily, the CAFA revenues help with the fund industrial and central assessed appraisal work, in addition to general fund. And 90% of CAFA revenues are distributed to counties through a grant process that we administer. So counties file for a grant, give us their information, and then we administer or send out the grant money. One question. These two graphics are intended to show a little bit of glimpse, and I think you saw, some of you that were here a couple years ago would have seen the graphic on the left, at least, about CAFA receipts and charges and how those are kind of separating over time. CAFA generally has, as a revenue source, has been relatively flat for last few years. You can see it kind of dipping up and down a little bit, but generally pretty flat. And then the expenses, though, are growing more than the revenue that's available. So there's a growing gap there. And the second graphic is intended to show, just at the county level also, for CAFA receipts, that the same thing exists there, the same dynamic, that the portion of, and CAFA is intended to help fund the assessment and taxation work in the counties. The same pattern exists there, where as a percentage of the expenses, it's dropping a bit. So as a longer term or a revenue source for funding assessment and taxation functions, it's kind of, it's trailing off a bit in terms of being able to keep pace with expenses, both at the department and in the counties. Assistance, next one. Other assistance to the counties will do. We're seeing new industries and increasing complexity and valuing properties requires a greater appraisal expertise. So we find ourselves helping out a bit more there and training people. Many of our newer appraisers that we're hiring, we've been fortunate, I think, in that we've been able to fill. Appreciate a year ago that the legislature gave us some funding to fill some of the positions that we'd been holding vacant. And so we were able to fill those. Even in a time where the market has been increasing and maybe a fee appraiser demand is up for those resources as people are buying and properties, but we were able to fill the positions that we were given the funds to fill. But in some cases, they don't have a lot of prior appraisal experience, and so we're having to do a bit more training for those newer folks to bring them up to speed to do this work. But they've all made it through the trial service period now as of, I think, yesterday or so, and they're head on into now in our new season, which is just starting for industrial properties.
Editor?
Put a little more meat on the bones of the first bullet, new industries and increasing complexity in valuing properties. Are these technology businesses, or talk a little bit about that profile of business and why it's more complicated?
Yeah, Senator Manning, Senator Johnson, Chair Manning, sorry. So a couple of examples would be things like wind farms that are still relatively new area that we've had to get expertise in. The data centers that you hear about in terms of trying to value data centers, something that's been more recent that we've been trying to lend some help to the counties on was this something called the dark store theory. It's an idea around some of the big box stores, large stores that want to be valued more as if they're not in business now, or because they're not as saleable. It's not as easy to sell the business and get because they're kind of unique to that particular business. And so we've been lending some support there to the counties and how they should address something like that kind of an argument. And low-income housing comes up sometimes too.
Mr. Chair, I don't understand that at all. Somebody builds a big box and doesn't populate it with consumer goods, or
No, it's going concern. It's operating now as a business, but they'll make an argument that it should be valued essentially as if it was not, because there's not a ready market for it, or some of these sit vacant after they sell for a while. So they're trying to argue that it should be valued at less than what we think it should be, because it is operating, they're in business, and so we apply more traditional appraisal techniques to it. So it's just one of the theories that's kind of out there in advance that we're having to now address working with the counties, if that helps. So those are just some of the examples of where increase in complexity or arguments that are being made. Hope that helps. The last bullet point on there just talks about as counties experience, if they have experience in reductions in appraiser resources, or sometimes asking for more help from the department also to appraise some complex properties. Technology, some of the improvements that have happened in the last couple of years in the property tax area. One is around the CAFA. I mentioned CAFA earlier, the County Assessment Function funding and the grant program. So the application process that they use is now a web-based process, which is helpful for the department and counties. A little easier, do it online, more modern. Appraiser continuing education demands are being met with increased online courses. We talked about that a little bit earlier in response to Senator Johnson's question. So we've been able to do more of that. And right now we're also working on a new web-based training records access for counties so they can monitor. They have a continuing education requirement for the appraisers. And so we have a records database of the training that they receive, so they can go in, and this will automate that, make it much easier for them to go in and see how they're doing, for the assessor to see how his or her staff are doing and keeping up with continuing ed requirements. That's supposed to be done in April or so.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Manning. I wondered how, in this on this question of education, continuing education, how you train people in terms of the more esoteric functions of the department, the central assessment and the intangibles issue that isn't done in other states. So how do we get people up to speed on that?
Yeah, Chair Manning, Representative Marsh. In the case of that, since we do the central assessment work at the Department of Revenue, not in the counties, so we're really focused on our own staff then,
right,
for that training. But we do have to, of course, train any new staff, which we have some that are doing that now in central assessment. But at least it's kind of contained to within our division and a small number of people, and then the people that are experts are able to provide training to them. Does that answer your question?
It does, and I realize you were talking about the ones in the county, so my timing was off here. But it does seem like quite a challenge when you're dealing with issues that we simply, you know, are unique to Oregon in terms of getting staff up to speed and doing it in a controversial area.
Yeah. Well, Representative, also, I mean, we are able to work with some other states that have central assessment. So there's one of the organizations we work with called the Western States Association of Tax Administrators, and they have they do quite a bit of volume work around central assessment, so that at least the states can work together and help provide training to each other, provide consistent methods for how to value central assessed properties. So we're not alone, even though the base might differ sometimes between states as to what they include, like whether intangibles are included or not. But at least we do have other states that do central assessment work, and we get to work with them. Hope that helps.
Yeah.
Let's switch over to property valuation system. So this is one, well, for some of you that have been on the committee over the last year, 2 years, have heard us talk about a property valuation system. And this is really focused in that area that does the industrial property valuation and central assessment. 2015 legislature did approve work towards this system, a property valuation system, to modernize. We have a very various databases, spreadsheets, some paper processes, back and forth exchange of CDs in the mail with companies now. So we definitely feel a need to modernize all the system that we use for valuing these properties. We are in the process, so we started. We've been going through the stage gate process that I don't know how many of you are too familiar with, but with the state and working with the Office of the State CIO to move through stage gate. We're through stage gates 1 and 2 and working on stage gate 3 right now.
Mr. Humphreys, can I ask you to back up one slide again? The web-based training, we've been, you know, none of it seems that all the presentations that we have, there's no two agencies that's been able to actually talk to each other, and everybody is doing individual things with upgrading their web technologies and stuff. So can you talk a little bit more about what the web-based training is, who's doing the training, and what are the expected outcomes for the training?
Well, Chair Manning, I'll give you what I know about it. I might have to have some others help me with to get into any details on that. But in this case, what we're doing within the property tax division is, so we'll have a couple of people who are working on providing that training, come up with the training content, get it put on the web for the counties. Primarily, it really is for the counties, so we do have a somewhat limited audience that is using and accessing that training. It's not across, across the state, all sorts of other appraisers. But as far as coordination with other agencies, I'd have to, if that's part of where you're going, I'd have to look at that.
If someone can come back with, with that, I've got some concerns, not particularly to DOR, but to most of our state agencies when we're talking about IT and IT technology and platforms that we're using. seems that we've invested in the past millions of dollars and stuff to, you know, make sure that we get these systems right. And some of them don't seem to be functioning as, you know, where they were supposed to be designed to do. Not saying that it's your system, but, you know, I want to take a look at all of the systems and find out about the investment that the state has made in these IT web portals and platforms and stuff, and the things that are not working, and then what happened to the money. So, again, it's not particularly to DOR, but, you know, I'm looking at it across all agencies.
Okay. Yes, and, Mr. Chair, we do have, I mean, tomorrow we might get a little bit of more perspective from our CIO when he's here for the agency. Might have some information for you, but we'll certainly look into
the
question more.
Thank you.
Thank you. So flipping back to the property valuation system, I mentioned where we're at in kind of the stage gate process. And I didn't mention it's a computer-assisted mass appraisal that we're looking for. There are companies out there that provide these services. 34 of the 36 counties in Oregon have already purchased or are using a CAMA solution now that's from one of the vendors that is an expert in this area. So we've been going down this path then of trying to get also a CAMA solution that we could use. Differences are that, I mean, for the counties, you know, they're primarily looking at residential and commercial type properties to value. And then, of course, as we've talked about, ours is principally these industrial and central assessed properties, which aren't something a lot of these companies maybe do a lot of, or if any, some of the vendors. So that's a bit different for them as they look at what they can provide to us. But we do have, we're in an RFP process now and request for proposal, and we have some proposals for a couple of the vendors that are in this community that offer this type of a product. And so we continue down that. We had some bond sale money that was sold and are available to us to use this biennium that you had approved for covering costs for like project management and quality assurance vendors. We've contracted with a company to provide project management expertise to it, and then we have a quality assurance vendor also that's working with us. And then we're working on the solution provider. That's what the RFP is for now, is who would provide that. And we're in the midst of evaluating the proposals we received. So I don't really have a firm number for you on that yet today. But we'll come back in a few weeks. We'll be coming back with more information and a request for you related to this project. This slide talks a little bit about some of the benefits we see in PVS as far as a comprehensive system that helping with the appraisal process and consolidating data, electronic exchange of information. I mentioned CDs going back and forth or paper, you know, that we could have a more electronic exchange with counties online. Data analytics, reporting capabilities, many of the same types of things that we've talked to you or Eric's talked to you about related to the large CSR project. E-filing option we're hoping to have. There's not really as much of the e-filing that's out there now in the counties in some of this property tax area, but there's some, and so we're hoping to be able to have that as part of this. That'd be an important piece. Stable IT platform for appraisal activities. I mentioned we have pretty disparate systems now. Reliance on, in our case, pretty much one person that really knows the current type systems we use, so that's not a lot of redundancy and not a lot of assurance, and more efficient use of appraiser time. So if we can get our appraisers spending more of their time on actual appraising properties doing the value, that will be helpful. So that's some about the benefits. And then the last slide I think I have in the property tax area is just to talk a little bit about, I mentioned core system replacement, the Gentax solution, and some of the impacts we've seen. Principally so far, it's been in the tax deferral program, the senior deferral and disabled. We're able to get to locate taxpayer information more quickly, such as their applications, their recertification. They do have to recertify every couple of years. Access to liens, links to property addresses. We're able to get faster, more accurate customer service to the clients, the people that we're serving. Fewer seasonal resources necessary compared to the prior season. That's just that you've authorized a certain number of seasonal staff to help with the work, but the more that we're becoming proficient with the Gentax solution, that we didn't have to hire quite as many of the seasonal resources we had previously, and hopefully that trend continues. There's workflow management that's improved. We're able to look and see where we're at, how different people are doing, so we can keep track of that better with this also. And I don't know, unless there's questions, I don't too much more on that. But phase four then is what will be coming this fall. And we some programs we have in that are timber programs are part of that. Gas and oil tax, these are small ones kind of that we have. Gas and oil tax, electric co-op, small private rail car. Those are all programs that will be folded into and roll out for the Gentax solution to do billing and do our work. So those are, and so we appreciate that you've been able to provide that system for us to use in this area also. I know most of the impact of Gentax is in other divisions, but there is some that benefits the property tax division as well. So that's all I have on the property tax area, unless there's more questions.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. All righty. Well, we'll move into the what we call our special programs. And yesterday when I was here, I shared with you the role the business division plays in administering some of our income tax programs. Today, what I'm going to share with you are several other programs that the business division administers. We've grouped several together, as you can see on this slide, and the category that we've given them over the years is our special programs, and SPA stands for Special Program Administration. I'll begin with this slide, and I think I got to go back one. For the cigarette and tobacco tax programs, you saw this slide when Director Ray gave her overview of the programs. Today, what I'll do is talk about the special programs, other agency accounts administration, which is the collections we do on behalf of other agencies, and then finally, I'll talk about a marijuana tax program. But starting off with the cigarette and tobacco tax programs, like we talked about yesterday in the administration of the income tax programs, many of the things that we do to administer these programs are similar in terms of education and assistance, the top row there, banking, the enforcement efforts we do. This program generates a little over $500 million per biennium. And on the bottom line there, you can see the various programs that the cigarette receipts fund across the across the state. You can see a large chunk of it goes to the Oregon Health Plan. Some goes to the general fund. And then you can see mental health programs, some local programs, including transit and smoking cessation programs. One of the things I wanted to bring forward with regard to cigarette and other tobacco tax programs is we've been able to take advantage of some of the they were in rollout one, by the way, for our systems integration that we went live with in the fall of 2014. And one of the things we've been able to do is to allow the cigarette distributors who stamp cigarettes. So the way cigarettes are stamped in Oregon is distributors buy stamps from a vendor that makes and sells the stamps. Each stamp has a unique number. And then the vendor takes and opens the carton, the machines do this, and then seals the stamps on the bottom of the cigarette cart or packs and then seals it up and sends it out. We used to keep the inventory of those stamps at the Department of Revenue. And when we were able to build an online portal for them, they can now, the distributors can now order the cigarettes from us online, and then we've made an arrangement with the vendors who sell the stamps that we notify them of the stamp order, and then the stamp vendor sends the stamps directly to the distributor and then notifies us of what stamps were sold to the distributor. So we have the series of stamp numbers that the distributor has, and we're no longer playing the middleman for keeping track of the inventory of the cigarette stamps. And so it's one way we've been able to be more effective and to help that community. And all of the distributors in Oregon now order their cigarette stamps online. One of the other things that we're doing in the cigarette and tobacco tax programs, yesterday I mentioned about the Federation of Tax Administrators and the things we're doing to try to be more equitable and uniform. Actually, that the WSADA program Gary talked about is the western region of that group. That's how they're working to be more standardized and they're centrally assessed. We're also working to be more uniform in how cigarette taxes are reported and paid in the state of Oregon. And so this fall, we're going to, in our new system, put out a new return and allow the cigarette companies to file with us. But it will also pick up some of the other reporting that's required for the regulation of the trafficking of cigarettes that's used by other agencies. And so it'll be a combined return as well. And then the other thing I'd just like to mention about the cigarette program is in Oregon, we're pretty fortunate. We have good relationships with the tribes. Not all states have a relationship with the tribes where the tribes will sell tax product. Our tribes, 8 out of the 9 tribes that are recognized in Oregon, actually sell taxed cigarettes on their tribes. And then what we do is quarterly reimburse them for the difference between what the tax amount was and what this the product was. And it's in 2016, we refunded $1.3 million back to the tribes. What that does is it helps compliance in Oregon for the cigarette tax to be pretty high. There are other states that don't have those arrangements, and as you can imagine, people will go to where the tribes are located and buy in bulk there the untaxed product, and it's a hole in the compliance in other states. In Oregon, we're very fortunate to have those agreements with our tribes. We're now starting to enter into those agreements for other tobacco tax, which is we have one agreement with one tribe now, and we're negotiating agreements with 2 other tribes. So we're trying to make sure that we also have those products that are also taxed on the tribes as well. Another program I'd like to touch on is the Emergency Communications Tax Program. Just briefly touch on a few of these smaller programs. This one's not real small. It generates almost $84 million. It's the projection for the 15-17 biennium. The receipts from this tax, this is the 75 cents you might see on your phone bill each month, is to fund the E911 call centers throughout Oregon. We implemented this program in our second rollout in the fall of 2015. One change that the legislature made, there was a challenge over the years as people started using more and more prepaid phones, is how do you collect the tax for that prepaid phone? It's not a landline. And so a change was made legislatively to collect that tax at the point of sale. And so we implemented that with our rollout and rollout two. And so now we have the retailers who are selling those reporting the tax that's associated for those sales to the department. And we have 98% of the retailers filing that online. And last month, I believe, we presented a report to the Revenue Committee about that program. If there's more interest in that, you can get that report.
Senator?
You said you had this very high percentage of retailers filing online. What about the 2% of miscreants? What's the plan?
Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, we are able to help them and receive a return and enter it for them. If they, for some reason, can't do online transactions, we're able to assist them by getting the information. They can file it with us in paper, and then we'll key that in for them.
Okay, so you have really 100% participation. This is just the electronic version.
For those that we know of who should be participating, yes. And that's, if you see the report, the 911 report, that was reported to the revenue committees, we're still evaluating the level of compliance in that industry.
Okay.
The next small program or special program I'd like to talk about is the state lodging tax. This tax supports tourism development in Oregon. The rate was increased from 1% to 1.8% as of July of last year. That program was rolled out in our third rollout of GenTax this fall. One of the benefits we were able to provide by bringing this program into the new system is that there are 10 tourism regions, and prior to going live in GenTax, if you were a lodging provider who was in multiple districts across the state, you had to file a separate return for each region. We've consolidated that into one return so that you can file one return for all regions, and then we do the processing on our end to distribute the funds to those regions where appropriate. We didn't have a processing system prior to this, and so we're able to also do some checks and balances to validate that the returns we're getting appear to be accurate. Again, the thing that's, I think, remarkable about this program is it just went live in November, and for the first quarter's filing, over 90% of the people who participate in this program filed their returns electronically with us. And this program, I don't know if I mentioned it, it should generate just under $70 million, according to the OEA forecast for the 17-19 biennium.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Give me 30 seconds on Airbnb and vacation rentals and other lodging providers that aren't as visible or as active or easy to contact.
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, yes, that's been an issue that has been a nationwide issue, even for other states that administer sales tax for these kinds of providers. It's been a topic that's been discussed in the revenue committees over the years. We are doing education and assistance to try and inform those people that they do have a filing responsibility, and working with the industry to get the word out about their filing requirements. And so it's something that's on our radar, and it's something that we're continuing to keep an eye on.
Yes, if I could, Mr. Chair. It's on your radar, I understand that, but I'm also interested in your compliance efforts. Are you, for example, looking at web pages, looking at advertisements, tracking down people who are offering lodging but not paying into the state system?
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, great question. If you notice, if I go back to that slide, the bottom bullet, we're allocated 2% of the revenue collected from that program for our administrative costs. And so one of the things that we have not had a great deal of ability to do is do a lot of enforcement on that particular program. And it's something that we're, with the larger fee increase from the 1 to 1.8%, we're hopeful that we'll have more revenue to work with to try and do more compliance in that program area. But it's not been something, I was there in 2003 when the program was initiated and we talked about enforcement. Nobody wanted enforcement. Tourism didn't want it. They said, just administer the program. At that time, you didn't have some of these third-party providers in the arena either, at least to the degree we have today. And so that's something that's a growing concern, is how can we do enforcement? And so it's something that we're looking into right now, that it looks like we might have the revenue to do that. If you'd like more detail on what it is we're looking at, I can work with my staff to try and get you more information on that.
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chairman. So we have a lot of communities that have a fair concentration of lodging opportunities, I think particularly my own district on the coast. Is it fair to say that anybody who is paying a local lodging tax is in the state system?
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, that's a great question. They should be. I think if they are, they should be.
Okay. That information that Representative Gomberg requested, definitely would like to share that with the entire committee. Representative Marsh?
Well, let me add to the conversation. Revenue Committee just an hour ago or more passed approved legislation that you will get a chance to vote on that allows the Department of Revenue to talk to local governments, so you can actually compare the data that each entity has to see if we're getting reports from the same.
Good. I'm looking to Deanna to say, okay.
Right, Deanna?
Okay.
Absolutely.
Great.
And that should help with some of the clarification consistency of data.
That'll be very helpful. Thank you, Representative Marsh. But I'll still be happy to provide information and let you know about what we're thinking about our compliance strategy. And again, it's an emerging issue for this program.
No, I think that we'd be the committee would be very interested in whether the tactical approaches are, you know, what you perceive as the best way to approach that. I think that one of the issues that we are really dealing with is lost revenues or unidentified revenues that are out there, and how we can better bring those in, particularly because of the situation that we're in right now. And if we don't have everybody that's, you know, operating under the radar, then that's not fair for the rest of it. Yeah. Thank you.
We understand that completely, Chair Manning. Briefly, these two programs, the petroleum load fee and the hazardous substance fee. The petroleum load fee supports regional hazardous materials response teams throughout the state. And then the hazardous substance fee is administered on behalf of the state fire marshal to help support a public database of chemical sites throughout the state that people can have access to. Again, we're with the new system, we're able to see more online filing, we're able to do more billing. The 9,000 bills we're going to be able to send out, we'll be able to do through our system much more effectively. And that concludes the small programs or special programs presentation that I wanted to touch base on.
Questions from the committee?
But then I have the other agency accounts and marijuana programs I'd like to get to next.
Okay. No question. Let's roll on.
All righty. For a number of years now, since 1971, the Department of Revenue has been collecting on behalf of many other agencies in the state. We provide collection services for state agencies as well as boards, commissions. A large part of the debt that is in our profile is for courts, circuit and district courts, and a variety of educational and regulatory agencies. We offer two kinds of services. We offer full collection services, which means if you give us your account and we're allowed to statutorily, we'll put that in and we'll do the full range of collection. We'll make contact tax, we'll levy liens, we'll do garnishment. And then there's another category of accounts that we have that are just for refund offset. Because of the nature of the debt, and some agencies are restricted from us doing anything other than a refund offset, but we will be notified of a debt that an agency might have. And then if there's a tax refund that's due to that individual and we are notified that they have that debt, we will redirect that refund to pay toward that debt that they have. And so we also do that. That happens each year, as you can imagine, generally around the summer when you have your refunds that are coming from the filing season for the personal income tax program. We perform collection services for approximately 180 agencies at this time, and we charge a collection fee to those agencies, and that funds 62 positions. And our 15-17 legislatively approved budget was just over $9 million. And for the other agency accounts collection program, we had just over 60 FTE.
Let me ask a question. I have a smile on my face with this one, so just bear with me.
Okay.
Of the 180 agencies that you perform collection services, how many of those agencies are you able to fully collect? And if you're not able to collect, what happens to the debt?
Chair Manning, so the fully collect, I just want to make sure I understand the question. We have the two services, one is full collection and one is offset. And so there could be a split in those agencies for those that we do full collection for as well as those we don't. So that's one answer. With regard to what do we do with how well we collect or what we keep the debt for a certain period of time. We analyze the debt as we're managing our accounts receivable. Joanne talked about this yesterday. The way we approach the receivables for this debt's the same as we do for individual income tax or withholding. Is if it's out of state, it's likely that it'll probably go to a private collection firm right away. We won't touch it. Depending on the age of the debt or the type of the debt or the kind of information we have on the debt, we may approach it a different way. Any debt that's aged over a certain period of time, and I'm trying to recall off the top of my mind, I think it's 6 months for OAA, it will go to a collection agency if we've had no payment and no activity on a debt after 6 months. And so we won't keep it in our queue. It's not something we can be effective at working, so we'll move it out. There are certain agencies that were restricted depending on the agreements we have with them or statutory requirements about what we can and can't do with their debt. And so I appreciate the question, and we have to work with each of the circumstances that we're dealing with, not only the agency and what we're allowed to do, but also the type of debt, the condition of the debt, and then decide how it is we're going to work with it. But a lot of our debt that gets old goes to a private collection firm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two questions, Mr. Chairman. First of all, if I'm not mistaken, when the Department of Revenue is trying to collect income tax revenues that are delinquent, you have the opportunity to attach an individual taxpayer's tax refund. Is that equally true of debt that comes to you from other agencies, or are you precluded from attaching their tax refunds?
Chair Manning, Representative Gombrich, if I understand your question, to use that refund to offset that debt, yes, we can do that.
Second question, Mr. Chairman, with Senate Bill 89 progressing through the building at this point, should that measure be implemented, it's going to land a lot more debt on you folks. I'd like to know a little bit about your potential plans and particularly your staffing levels should you get that dramatically increased opportunity.
Yes, Chair Manning, Representative Gombrich, we are paying very close attention to that bill. We actually had, if I could, just to back up a little bit, give a little background, in our agency request budget, we had asked for, I think, 12 or 13 positions that we thought would get us to the level that we would need just for the debt we currently had. As we were seeing the amount of debts we have in the full collection debts, I think we average around $350 million in our portfolio at any given time. That can ebb and flow depending on the debts that are coming and going. That usually represents around 90,000 accounts. And so based on the recovery that we've been able to work on those accounts, we felt like we needed to have a little more staff even before Senate Bill 89 came along. With Senate Bill 89, the fiscal impact that we've provided, I believe, asked for 10 more positions, and that's to be able to manage that debt. And I believe based on the information that we've gotten, I think it's estimated, I'm trying to look here, about how many debts. maybe about 16,000 new debtors, maybe 35,000 new accounts in that range. And so we're using that ratio. It's about a third more debt. And so if you look at the total of a couple dozen positions compared to 60, it's in that same ratio. If we were to be straightforward about what we think we'd need to do to continue to provide the service we've been providing. Did that answer your question?
It answered my question.
Okay.
So let me get just a little bit, just back up again. The 180 agencies, say if I'll pick on DAS right now. If they sent over, said that, hey, we would like for you to collect on this debt, and it comes to you, and it over a period of time, the debt has not been collected, do you forward it to a collection agency, or does that go back to DAS?
It can depend, but we will do both. I think, do we send it back to the agency and they send it to the collection firm now? Okay, so we send it back to the agency and they send it to the collection firm. It's under Senate Bill 89 that we would be able to then, the department could then send it directly to the collection firm.
Okay, so which would be more cost effective than, in your opinion, whether it's, does DAS try to collect upon it and just use them as an example?
Sure, I understand.
And then all of a sudden they say that, okay, well, we're unsuccessful. Then they send it over to you, say, hey, can you collect upon this after they fail to collect upon it? And then when it gets to you, it's not collectible. And you said, okay, well, we held it for the amount of time. It's coming back to you guys. And, you know, you go ahead and do what you think is best. Is that how processes have worked in the past, or is that, help me understand how the process works.
Chair Manning, I think you reasonably described the process in the past, and I think that's the intent behind Senate Bill 89, is that the state is looking at how can we centralize and create efficiencies of streamlining how we move debt, especially from smaller organizations. There are some agencies that they need their own collection function, child support, for example. And there's just certain things that they have a collection workforce, and it's appropriate for them. But for a lot of the other folks, they aren't experts in collection, and it's something that we're skilled and equipped to do. And so that's, I think, the intent behind Senate Bill 89, is to get to be more effective like you're describing, so it's not pinging back and forth. It comes to us. We can assess it. We're given the ability to move it through the process the way we see best, whether it's to a private collection firm or handle it ourselves, hold it for offset.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you need more, you need to move on, I'm happy to hold these questions for another time. First of all, I'm interested. We've got the current scenario and we've got the potential scenario under 89. Either way, you've got debt coming to you from a variety of different agencies. Tell me that the first thing you do when you get these reports is consolidate them to ensure that that David Gomberg may not owe money to three or four different agencies, rather than having three or four different revenue agents chasing me down.
Thank you, Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg. One of the things we're able to do in Gentex now, and we just rolled out in rollout three, is take a better look at the debt we have. It was very manual prior to getting it into Gentex, and we're able to apply several different types of analytics to it. Companionating the debt is one thing we can do. The other is now we can look and see what debtors have assets that we're aware of that we can find. They have wages, or they even have a phone number. On the flip side, what debtors have public assistance that we shouldn't be contacting because they're protected? I mean, sometimes it took a phone call to find that out when it was being done manually. And so we're early. We just came out in rollout three, but we're very happy to have the tools we have now to have the visibility into the debt portfolio, if you will, to be able to better manage the debt, to prioritize it, to look for where we can consolidate debt or link it to work it more effectively.
Final question, Mr. Chairman. The other thing that fascinates me about some of these amounts is that agencies will apply, in some cases, fines to an individual that they don't expect to collect but are there for symbolic purposes and to dissuade other people perhaps from doing business with them down the road. Do you triage this debt when it comes in? The local agency that sends you this is going to know more about the account than you do when you get it, but I'm interested if we are categorizing these accounts as eminently collectible, possibly collectible, or in your wildest dreams, collectible.
Chair Manning, Representative Gomberg, we actually are aware of the success we have given the different types of debt from different entities, and we look at what are the better approaches for those debts. And so triage is probably a good word for that. We don't know as much about the debt as we do as the agency might in specifics, but we've seen over the years we worked with different types of debts, just our success rates given the different types of debts, and that informs us of how we should manage that and where we put our resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. I think you helped me cover my next slide. No, with your questions. Thank you. Just a couple things about the online features, too. This program didn't have any online features prior to going live in Gentex, and there's three categories of individuals who are able to benefit from. One is the debtors. They can now pay online. They can set up a payment plan online. They don't need to wait for us to contact them or for them to call us. They can view their account balances online. We've already had several hundred payments in each month since we've gone live from people who are going online to make payments. Those are payments that in the past they had to call us to make a payment and give us their credit card. So that's a nice benefit. Our client agencies, those 180 agencies that we've been talking about, can now do business and transact with us online. Before, it was an exchange of information that took a lot of manual intervention. They can report payments that they've accepted for debt that we have so we can adjust the debt in our portfolio. They can review and update debt balances if for some reason they need to change a debt balance that's in our portfolio. And they can have access to debtor account reports to see how are we doing at collecting on behalf for their debtors. And then the last thing that I think is an important feature for those in the community that help us with these are the employers that we send garnishments to. They can review garnishment balances online. They can respond to garnishments electronically, and they can make garnishment payments to us online. So there are a lot of things that we're leveraging the new system to do to try to make it more effective for us and for the people we're working with to transact with us on these other agency account debts. Last couple slides on other agency accounts, and this is just a snapshot of time. Just like we talked about yesterday with accounts receivable, that's all an accounts receivable is. For a given point in time, here's what the portfolio looked like. As you can see, this is as of October of 2016 for the inventory that we had that was what we call unrestricted or in full collections. The vast majority of it is court debt, as I talked about earlier. That's where the biggest bulk of the receivables that we're working on from OAA land. The next category is business debt. You can see some from OHSU, schools, corrections, and PERS. And then in terms of I'm sorry.
Before you go back, please, court debt.
Yes.
That's a pretty tricky one. You know, we know that people... Well, my understanding, a lot of this court debt is for offenders in mostly often criminal cases and stuff that are possibly going to be incarcerated, and they're going into jail with this debt. Is that money reflected up in here? Because, you know, looking at it realistically, if someone is incarcerated, that money is not coming anywhere. You're not going to see that money. So is that part of this court debt?
Senator Manning, good segue to my next slide, which is recoveries. Believe it or not, we do pretty good. And I actually anticipated that question, and the response I had from my staff was, you wouldn't believe some of the assets some of these people who are incarcerated have. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't a number of people who are incarcerated who don't have that. But as you can see, the greatest level of our recoveries are also for the court debts. I hope that answers your question. And that was my last slide for the other agency accounts presentation. And now, if you allow me, I'll move on to the marijuana tax as my last presentation.
May I ask you a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Do you engage with the Department of Employment at all if there are overpayments in the unemployment insurance realm? I recall several biennia ago there was like a $25 million overpayment in the aggregate. And I never knew how much effort was made to recoup that. I know in some cases people had spent it, and you're not going to get blood out of a rock. Mm-hmm. But do you do any business with UI? Unemployment insurance?
Yes. Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, yesterday in the income tax presentation, Joanne Martin and I talked about the things that we do. And when I gave the withholding tax, I talked about the combined return that we use in partnership with employment and the data exchange that we're doing with them. And so, yes, we do exchange information. We try and reconcile, I believe, daily where balances don't line up with what was reported or what we think should be allocated to the different agencies. And so if there's a specific example example, I don't know that I can speak to that, but I know that we work very hard with employment and with DCBS, as well as the two transit districts that we work with, to continuously reconcile, make sure that the receipts that are in are being accurately and appropriately distributed and appropriately collected.
Thank you.
You bet. The last program I'd like to touch on today is the marijuana tax. It's our newest tax program. You saw this slide again when Director Ray gave her overview a couple weeks ago. Again, the top band just talks about the different types of activities we do. It's very similar to the activities I discussed yesterday with Joanne Martin about how you administer a tax program. Of note for this program, this is through December of 2016. It had generated a little over $60 million in receipts. And when we do get to distribute the funds, at least based on existing law, the bottom is in this summer is when we're scheduled to make our first distribution. The bottom line is the different entities that are set to receive distributions from these funds. So the school fund, drug and alcohol abuse, state police, law enforcement in the local communities, as well as OHA for alcohol and drug abuse.
Senator?
One of the things that I have pined for is an overall expense and income for marijuana. Because none of us sit on all committees, we see the marijuana in little nibbles, you'll excuse the expression. And I know that when the program was first starting, we were fronting a lot of money, money that came out of the liquor reserve, money that came, you guys needed to fortify your building and put a bunch of procedures in place. I never saw the totality of the expenses. Consequently, I don't know how much of the putative revenue is going to get used to backfill or to pay back the front end loading. And Mr. Borden just moved his mic, so I bet you know the answer.
Go ahead.
Co-Chair and Senator Johnson, we'll get you that information. We have it. Teresa McHugh of our office put out a budget brief that talks statewide about it, and we have some updated numbers from that, so we'll be happy to get that.
Shame on
you.
Me for not looking at the budget brief, but that would be great, because I don't know how much we took $10 million out of the liquor fund. And
there are several initial quote-unquote loans against the payments. Patrick may have a better idea than I do, but there are some of those payments that will continue into the 17-19 biennium that will need to be taken care of. And so until one of the delays in the distribution of funds, of course, is that the full accounting needs to be done and those loans repaid before any distributions can be handled. So, but we'll get you that information.
Thank you, and I'll look up the issue brief.
And Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, I know that our portion of the 15-17 LAB was about $3.8 million, just to give you an idea of what revenues piece of that was.
Thank you. One other question. How are those improvements working in terms of your staff security and in terms of dealing with a lot of cash with its own whole set of problems?
Chair Manning, Senator Johnson, we are just beginning construction for the permanent cash handling facility right now. We've been using our temporary facility, and it has been working. We have somebody on staff whose full-time job is security for the building and helping us to make sure we're not only secure as we can be now, but looking toward how we can be as secure as we can be in the future. Thank you for asking.
I guess one more is, this is asking you to look into your crystal ball. If there's a change in federal policy with respect to cannabis, what effect that's going to have on us with regard to revenue? And you're good. You're not a mind reader. So
And I would have to say I would probably look to the legislative revenue staff and those who are more expert in the revenue impact piece to help answer that. I wouldn't even hazard to take a guess.
That's fair.
Okay. The next slide here, just a little bit of background for any of you who may not be as familiar with the program. There was an early start to the program with a higher tax rate than is currently in place right now. It started in January of 2016 at a 25% rate. Currently, if anyone is selling recreational marijuana, they have to have a license from LCC. They're called a recreational marijuana retailer, and the rate now is set at 17%. Medical marijuana purchases are granted an exemption at the point of sale from paying the tax. The business has remit monthly payments, as Senator Johnson had just asked, and so we deal with that. And then they file quarterly returns, and the returns are filed online. A new development is this fall, a number of local jurisdictions decided that they would also like to have marijuana tax for the program in their communities. And so 95 municipalities have imposed an additional 3% tax on the sale of marijuana at those sites. And we worked with the League of Oregon Cities to put together an intergovernmental agreement so that we can actually administer that local tax on behalf of 70 communities or municipalities that have asked to have us do that work on their behalf. So it'll be reported to us, we'll get it, and then we'll redistribute it back out to those local municipalities. Here's just a picture of the receipts since its inception. As I said, $60 million through December. Payments exceeded initial projections, if you weren't aware of that. They peaked in October, and they've declined since. One of the things I'd note is that the overall revenue from this program is probably limited just by the potential size of the consumer base. You know, it's one of those smaller programs in our mind. It's still a lot of money, but it's a program that's probably at some time going to level out depending on what happens in the community.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out that although marijuana growers and stuff cannot deposit in a bank, that the state deposits into an FDIC-insured bank, and there's a contradiction there in law. So the quicker we can get the feds to let them have bank accounts, the more tax revenue we will have, and the less danger we'll have of people hauling all that cash around.
Segue to cash payments. We're securely processing cash payments while we're constructing the centers I just described with Senator Johnson. As I mentioned a bit ago about distributions, we're monitoring current legislation. There may be some changes to the distribution, but again, we're still not planning on making any distributions till this summer, until after everything's been accounted for and reconciled. One of the things, and this is my last slide, one of the things that we've observed is that in this business, there is a lot of inexperience with the things that are required of a business and compliance. And so we have been spending a great deal of time educating and helping people understand their filing requirements. There have been a number of people who have been paying regularly, but we haven't been getting the returns. And the number of returns is growing, but we've noticed that there's been a great deal of effort on our part to do an education and assistance to help those people understand why those reports are important. And then my final comment about this program is just the novelty of it. Yesterday I talked to you about two programs, our withholding program, which is over a $6 billion a year program, our corporate program, which is over a $600 million a year program. This is about a $60 million a year program, at least for the first year. The amount of attention that this gets from the press and from others that are interested in it, it dwarfs the attention we get for the other programs. So there's quite a bit of novelty with this program, and it's something we have to respond to as well. And that concludes my presentation.
Questions from the committee? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, before this group leaves, I just wanted to say to Mr. Humphrey that earlier this year I did some work with the Property Tax Division dealing with personal property taxes. Yes. And the fact that that the first $16,000 on any individual's account is actually exempt from taxation. Still, our small businesses were being required to fill out form after form after form, only to find that they didn't know anything. And the department was very helpful in creating what I'll essentially call a short form, which is saving our small businesses hundreds, if not thousands, of hours across the state in completing those documents every year. And I really want to say I appreciate the good work that was done on that.
Thank you.
Ah, see, you get kudos if you hang around a little while. There. So, staff. Well, this concludes the there's no one else out there for public testimony, so I guess this will conclude the public hearing on SB 5535. Finally, staff, anything for the good of the cause?
Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, tomorrow will be the agency's final day with their Administrative Services Division and Information Technology section, and there will be public testimony today tomorrow to conclude the week. So,
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
All right. Well, with that in mind, we are adjourned, and we'll reconvene tomorrow, 1500, 3 o'clock for civilians. We are adjourned. For civilians, we are adjourned.